This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to my audio imaginarium, wishing you all a blessed, peaceful, joyous Christmas and a healthy, prosperous new year. Kalah Christuyana. And I want to acknowledge those of you who are listening, for whom this is a difficult time of year. Perhaps you recently lost someone very dear to you. Or perhaps, for whatever reason, you find yourself all alone during Christmas. Those of you not feeling well, those of you with loved ones that are facing some kind of health challenge, illness, disease, know that I am thinking of you and that you are not alone. Christmas is a time for miracles, and I believe in Christmas miracles. I'm very blessed. I have three Christmas miracles of my very own, at home, fast asleep, most likely, the mighty Aphrodite, of course, Zachary and North. If you are awake, why? and if you're awake, Merry Christmas to all of you. Let me tell you about a Christmas miracle that's sauntering down the hall as we speak. That would be the good Dr. George Ginescu. George is heading into his 65th or 66th year, 66th year in broadcasting. I've lost count, but George is the host of Big Band Sunday Night here on our flagship station in Toronto, AM 740. And I know for those of you listening in on one of our U.S. affiliates or the podcast, that name, George Ginescu, won't mean much. I've mentioned George from time to time. I only wish you could know him. He never toots his own horn, and you'd never know to meet him that he is the true spirit of Christmas personified. When I think of George Ginescu, I'm reminded of the last lines of Charles Dickens' Ebenezer Scrooge, or Christmas Carol. And it's as if Dickens was writing about George when he wrote, "It was said of him that he kept Christmas well, if any man alive possessed the knowledge." God bless you, George, and Merry Christmas. I always say, people are always saying, Christmas is for children, Christmas is for children. And I always say, it's not really. It's about a child, one very special child, born in Bethlehem under a wonderful star over 2,000 years ago. Having said that, however, I do want to mention a certain child who I'm sure is very excited about Christmas this year. What child isn't? But young Callum, who is three, I believe, is battling cancer. And beyond Christmas, he's staring at a round of intracranial radiation, I should say. And his mom and dad are big fans of the show, and I just want them to know that I'm thinking of them and Callum. And because I believe in Christmas miracles, I'll ask you all to keep Callum and his family from Denver in your prayers this Christmas. If you go to my Twitter feed, at Richard Serrett, I've got a couple of posts there about young Callum, and there's a picture of the little guy, beautiful little boy. Sometimes it helps to have a picture when you're saying a prayer for someone. So please keep young Calum in your hearts and in your prayers this Christmas. And also just a quick shout out to my nephew Michael, if you're listening. You're in my prayers too. Merry Christmas. Michael, remember, that's a very powerful name you have. It is the highest of the heavenly angels, and I believe he's watching over you right about now. I mentioned Jesus. It is the season, and 'tis the reason, rather, for the season. But most of us probably understand that Jesus probably wasn't born on December 25th. So if he wasn't born on the 25th of December, when was it, and does it matter? That's where we're going over the next 20 minutes or so. We're going to begin by opening up a mystery for this season. When was Jesus really born? And then in the second half of the hour, we're going to talk about the mystery of the Shemitah. We've discussed this before, but we'll get some updates. The continuing signs and manifestations of the Shemitah that may be warning us of a coming calamity and judgment. Jonathan Cahn is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Harbinger, and he's just come out with his new book, The Mystery of the Shemitah, the 3,000-year-old mystery that holds the secrets of America's future, the world's future, and your future. It's immediately become a national and New York Times bestseller, and it's causing quite a stir around the world. Jonathan leads the Jerusalem Center Beth Israel in Wayne, New Jersey, and he's president of Hope of the World, an outreach to people throughout the world. He's also known for uncovering the deep mysteries of the Bible and has 2,000 teachings and messages uncovering the mysteries available at Hope of the World. Jonathan Cahn, how are you?
Great, Richard. Great to talk to you.
Always a pleasure to have you. Now, listen, I somewhat hesitate. I don't know. May I wish you a Merry Christmas? How do you feel about Christmas?
Sure. I mean, well, I feel great about the birth of the Messiah.
Sure.
You know, so whenever the time is, anytime one can celebrate it. So, yeah, you know, we'll talk about when we believe it happened. But and listen, you can celebrate the birth of Messiah, the coming into the world of the light, anytime.
So wonderful. Then a very Merry Christmas to you. So Jesus was not born on December 25th. I think most of us sort of understand that. But if not December 25th, then when?
Yeah, well, the first thing is, you know, the first clue we have with this is the season. I mean, the reason why he would not have been born on December 25th is because, you know, if you go to Israel today, just as it was then, it is cold. It is the coldest season. It is the winter. It is rainy or snowing at times.
Right.
It's daunting. Forget about a pregnant woman traveling. I mean, even traveling under the best circumstances, you know. And then the idea of the shepherds being out. I mean, the one season they're definitely not going to be out. I mean, if any, is going to be winter out in their fields. So, and on top of that, the idea of the census, you know, the Romans had planned the census to get money, you know, so the worst possible season to do this, they would just never do it in the winter. In fact, Jesus, at one point when he's speaking about the end times, he says, pray your flight not be in the winter, because it just could not travel then. So
right.
Really the winter is ruled out, you know. But then what do we have left? You know, you have the autumn is also ruled out because 9 months before the nativity, Mary conceives, and she makes a journey down across Israel to see her cousin Elizabeth, who's
right.
pregnant with the man who will be John the Baptist.
That's right.
So that puts that in the winter. That puts another problem because, you know, again, then we have a journey which would be under the best circumstances, very hard for a young woman, but across Israel, but forget it on wintertime. So that leaves us with the summer and the spring. And so we have the summer. And the summer, you know, you could travel, but on the other hand, it is the working season. It's a season of the harvest. It's a season of when everybody's in the field, not the time the Romans would have a census because they're just not going to leave the field, number one. And the other mystery in with Jesus or Yeshua is that all the greatest events of the New Testament or the seminal events, they all happen on Hebrew holy days. You know, he comes into Palm Sunday. He comes into Israel. Well, Jerusalem, that is Nisan 10, that's the first Hebrew holy day that God gave the Jewish people. Then he dies on Passover, Nisan 14, 15, that's the other Jewish holiday. Then he rises on Nisan 16, which is the Hebrew feast of first fruits, as the first fruit. And then you have Pentecost. Even Pentecost is a Hebrew holy day called Shavuot.
Right.
So every single thing, really all the biggest events happen on the Hebrew holidays. So we would expect, you know, if his death does, then there'd be something significant about the birth linked to some Hebrew day, some special day. Well, the problem with the summer is you don't have any on top of it. So that kind of leaves us to one more season to start with. And what you got is, the only thing left is the spring. Now, with spring, All the clues really fall into place because, one, it would 9 months before the spring would be summer, you could travel. A time when a pregnant woman could be outside giving birth with her husband, yes, the spring works. And a time when shepherds are with their flock. In fact, you know, the times that shepherds are out in the fields at night in Israel would be one season of the year, which is the season when the lambs are born. And that the lambing season, well, the lambs are born in the spring. That's really the only time they would be out in the field watching for the birth of lambs. And, you know, kind of, you know, makes sense even, you know, theologically, because, you know, Jesus comes in as the Lamb of God.
Right, right.
He is born in Bethlehem, the place of the lambs, where actually the temple lamb sacrifices were raised, particularly in Bethlehem. He's greeted by shepherds who are watching, who are the ones who greet the births of lambs. So, you know, it really narrows it down to March, or, well, actually, February at the earliest, then March, April, May, maybe, but March and April are the key parts of that. And that narrows it down even more to a particular month in Israel, which is called Nisan. Now, Nisan literally means the beginning. I mean, so it's the month of the beginning. So it's a great, you know, here the birth, you know, it's going to be the beginning. It's the beginning of the age. Well, so it's the perfect time. And note also, there's Hebrew traditions that the great sages of Israel are born in Nisan and die in Nisan. And we know that Messiah, or Jesus, died in Nisan, and he dies as the Passover lamb. Well, one of the things that it's said about the Passover lamb is the Passover lamb is actually, you know, the actual lamb is a year old. It says a year old male without blemish. Well, that means that if the Passover lamb dies in Nisan and he's one year old, the lamb itself, that means he has to be born in Nisan. I mean, it just makes sense.
Right, right. In order to be a year old, right.
Yeah. And the other thing is there any, you know, is there any date on the Hebrew calendar that would be special, because everything, you know, would be of some significance that would be linked to this, and that it kind of has to fall in the right place? Because the other thing is, a prophetic mystery is that not only does Jesus, you know, fulfill all these things on the Hebrew holidays, but he does so in the order that they appear. In other words, you know, Nisan 10 is first, so that's the day actually they brought the lamb to Jerusalem or to their houses on Passover. Well, that's Palm Sunday. Then he goes to the death and resurrection. Everything goes in order. So if his birth goes in order, it would have to be before, you know, Passover. It would have to be sometime in Nisan. Before that, well, is there any date that's significant? Well, there is one date, and that one date is the date, it's Nisan 1. And the reason why that's significant is Nisan 1 is the true beginning of the sacred year. It's the real Jewish New Year, and we have an idea, you know, it said that Rosh Hashanah, the Feast of Trumpets, is the New Year. No, it's not. Biblically, there's only one. God says this is the beginning. So what, first of all, what more perfect Hebrew, it says, holy day that he'd be born on would be the beginning. It's the beginning of the beginning. Plus, the other.
Let me just get you to hold on to that, Jonathan, because we'll take a time out. Sure. We'll come back and delve into when was Christ born, unraveling a mystery of biblical proportions, quite literally. Jonathan Kahn is with us, the author of The Harbinger and The Mystery of the Shemitah, Otis Redding's version of White Christmas, and it's a good one, takes us out here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. I love Otis Redding's version of White Christmas so much, I thought we'd play it twice, once going out of the break and coming back in. We were actually also doing our hangout on air tonight, our HOA, as the kids call it, our hangout on air. And if you want to watch the program as well as listen to it, go to my Twitter feed, at Richard Serrett. While you're there, you can say hi and follow me. But on the Twitter feed, at Richard Serrett, it's up near the top. And there's a link there for the HOA. Just click on that link, and then you'll be able to stream it live on YouTube and join us here in studio. Jonathan Kahn is with us, president of Hope of the World Ministries and the author of, best-selling author of The Harbinger and Mystery of the Shemitah. Right now we're delving into the mystery of Christ's birth. When was he born? And not in December. Jonathan, you've sort of narrowed it down according to the clues that are laid out in the Bible as, well, it corresponds to really Easter or Passover.
Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, there's one day on the Hebrew calendar, again, Nisan 1, it's really the New Year's Day. And the interesting thing about Messiah's birth is that it has this quality or this effect that it changes history. It changes the calendar. I mean, this is where we get our calendar gets divided by his birth, you know. And it's interesting that, you know, there's this one day on the sacred calendar of God that also does that same thing, divides the calendar, and that's Nisan 1. It starts the new year.
Right.
And it's interesting that, you know, one of the things that happened with the early church is that, unfortunately, is they divorced the roots, you know, the Jewish roots, and it kind of Romanized it. And so they took the, you know, the Jewish context and put it in a Roman context. Well, interesting, because today, you know, we celebrate, they chose December 25th, which is linked to New Year's, which, again, in the Roman calendar, it has the same quality as in the Hebrew calendar, it would be Nisan 1. That's the New Year day. But then there's even more. I mean, this is, the show's called The Conspiracy Show. Well, you know, there's possibly a conspiracy here, too, because there's a, in the ancient church records, the church fathers, there's one church father called Hippolytus, and he's often cited as the one who came up with December 25th.
Saturnalia.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, exactly, Richard. I mean, that, of course, it was a pagan thing, and they appropriated it, but then they came up with, you know, justification for it.
Yeah, the early church did that a lot. I mean, it made sense to, in a certain extent, if you want to co-opt that, bring these new people into the fold, you take over their pagan holiday, and
exactly,
voila.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's not good history, you know, but it's exactly so. And so the thing is that they say that he's the one who had the earliest sighting of December 25th, but actually, what they found in the work that he has, it seems like his work has been doctored up. And from there's a work from the 3rd century or 200s called De Pascha Computis, which is universally seen as based on the lost work of Hippolytus. And it says, in it, Hippolytus says that Messiah is born in the springtime, linked to the Hebrew month of Nisan, which is the same thing, again, Nisan 1.
Right.
And then in the Lateran Museum in Rome, you know, there's an ancient statue of Hippolytus, which was, they think it was probably done soon after his death. And on it, it says in Latin, it says Genesis Jesus Christus, or the birth of Jesus, the Messiah.
Right.
And carved into the statue is the time which correlates with the spring, the Hebrew month of Nisan. So we don't know if this has been suppressed or what, but it's even there in the early church documents. But here's another thing. I mean, and this is really cool. And there's a lot. I mean, there are things, we won't have time, but things from the Dead Sea Scrolls and so much of, but here's something right here. That, you know, one of the things in the Gospel of John, it says the Word was with God in the beginning, the Word was God. Then it says the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Well, that's the incarnation.
So, right.
Now, or some translations say the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Well, the Greek word there for dwelt or tabernacle is the word skenoro. Now that's the same word that's used in the New Testament to speak of the tabernacle. And now, in other words, the incarnation of Jesus in the New Testament is linked to the tabernacle. And as the Word became flesh and set up a tent. In other words, when he took a body, he's setting up a tent. It's temporary. He comes into the tent.
Right,
well,
right.
The amazing thing is, in the Old Testament, there is the beginning of this, where it is actually the origin of this, where it is a picture, it's the only picture in the Bible that has this, where it says God actually set up a tent in the wilderness. It was called the tabernacle. And that tabernacle, when you put it into Greek, becomes that same word that's linked to when it says the Word became flesh, or talking about the incarnation. So what do we know about the tabernacle? Could it have a clue when God set up a tabernacle among his people in the wilderness? It was called the Tent of Meeting, where the glory of God actually dwelt with Israel in this tent. Could it have a clue? Well, the amazing thing is it does. I mean, an amazing so. First of all, the tabernacle was built. It took 9 months to build it, which is the same period of time of a human pregnancy. Number one, that you have that right there, and it begins right at Mount Sinai when Israel, in a sense, enters a covenant with God, which is a marriage. So now you have this 9 months coming together of this tabernacle. And remember, this is the key in John of the incarnation. Well, when was it finished? Well, the Bible gives the exact date of when it was finished, which would correspond to the birth, when this thing is the conception, from conception at Sinai to the finishing of the tabernacle of God. Well, it gives the date. Now, what is the date? The answer is in Exodus 40 and verse 1 and 2. It says, "You shall raise up the tabernacle of the congregation. You will put in there the ark," that's in it, that's where the presence of God was.
Right.
And here it says in Hebrew, "B'yom HaKodesh HaRishon Be'echad LaKodesh." Translation, "You will do this in the first month of the year, on the first day of that month."
Nisan.
What is the first month? It's Nisan. What is the first day? Nisan 1.
Wow.
So it's even in there. The tabernacle, the picture that the Bible gives of God tabernacling on earth gives the exact date as Nisan 1. And, you know, it's amazing because not only that, and we can't go into all the detail now, but even the priestly calendar and the Dead Sea Scrolls point to the same date of Nisan 1. There's even astronomy, the appearance, you know, we talk about what would have happened in the East, that the Magi, who were astrologers or astronomers back then, that's what it was.
They were Persian, right? They were Zoroastrians.
Persian, the Persian Zoroastrian caste of the priests who studied the stars all the time. You know, back then you didn't really have astronomers. They were all astrologers because they looked for signs in the stars. But, they're looking at it. Well, what would have caused them? And there's a whole thing we can go into, you know, the God willing in no time, but there was the occurrence where all these things line up in the East that they would have linked to Israel, and it's linked to, you know, what they had certain parts of certain planets they believe were linked to Israel, certain things meant a king or a star. And so put it all together, the event happens on Nisan 1, on 6 BC, Nisan 1. And by the way, we think, what we say, well, that's kind of strange. We're talking about 6 BC. Well, the thing is, we know the calendar is wrong on that. Jesus was not born in the year 1.
Because Herod the Great was dead by the year 1.
Yeah, he was dead, exactly. He was dead in 4 BC, and it says that, we know that from Josephus, and it says in that same thing, it says that Herod ordered the death of all the children in Bethlehem who were according to the appearance of the star, what the Magi told him, and so he ordered the death of all of them 2 years old and up. So he got 4 BC and 2 years old and up. Well, what does that mean? Well, it goes back to 6 BC. Well, when you put all these things together, not only the priestly calendar, also this astronomical calendar, all these things point to Nisan, not only the year, but Nisan 1, the exact date. I mean, really there is
That's
so
remarkable.
Much
remarkable.
To this and pointing to it. I'll just give a one little other mystery here with that, and that is, I call it the mystery of the Goel. And in the Bible, this mystery is this. There's a law that God gave to Israel that if a mother, or actually a wife cannot bear children and her husband dies, then the nearest relative, could be a brother, can redeem, in a sense, the line of the brother by marrying the widow and raising up children. And so that the person is called the Goel, which means the redeemer, but specifically a redeemer who intervenes in the line. Now, the interesting thing is, in the Bible, there's this mystery about the Goel, and that is that you keep seeing this intervening or intervention into one particular line or lineage in Israel, and that's the line of Judah. In the time of Judah, the very first, the one who started the line, you have this Goel redemption takes place. There's an intervention. Later on, in the book of Ruth, Boaz, this famous story of Boaz and Ruth, he marries Ruth, she's the widow, and becomes the Goel of Ruth, and he's also the line of Judah, and by the way, their baby is born in Bethlehem. It's like a growing mystery. Well, the final mystery of the Goel is that God himself is going to become the Goel. And he's going to intervene in the line of man. And it's going to be in the line of Judah, same line. It's going to be in Israel. He's going to come upon them and come upon Mary. And so you have this gigantic Goel redemption, like God marrying earth and marrying us and becoming one with us. You know, and from this is born Jesus or Yeshua in Bethlehem. Well, the time that Ruth would have conceived, when you look at the book of Ruth, when this Goel redemption would have taken place, would lead the birth of her son to the time of Nisan. In other words, the time of this Goel redemption is 9 months before Nisan, which is when it would have happened to Mary for it to be Nisan 1. So this is just another, you know, every single piece lines up to this exact time. And you can even trace it out by, you know, one thing we know is that we know that that John the Baptist was born 6 months before Jesus, and we know that his father was in the temple as a priest under a certain, you know, receiving this revelation. Well, we know there's actually an ancient priestly calendar that we can tell when this would have happened. And there's only two times of the year he could have been in that temple, and one of those times leads the birth of Messiah being, again, Nisan 1.
Wow, this is pretty well, this seems like it's nailed shut. I mean, how is this being received? When you deliver this message to pastors and parishioners and so forth, is there resistance to this? I mean, what's the big deal? Why can't we just acknowledge that Jesus was born April or Nisan 1, 6 B.C.?
Well, it's you know, I mean, I think the reaction, Richard, mostly is wow, you know, like wow, and like I knew most people, as you said at the beginning, know it cannot be December 25th, and so you know, there's only certain times it could be, and even really most historians will say, you know, just based on the one thing about the lambing season and the shepherds, right away it's got to be around that time. But most people are pretty, you know, like, whoa, you know, hey, yeah, you know. And really, listen, I mean, look at it. Look at the time. It's the time of the beginning. It's springtime. What a perfect, this is the time of new beginnings. It's the beginning of the beginning. It's even in Hebrew, God called the month the beginning. I mean, it's kind of like, in some ways, pretty obvious, you know. But most people, I think, unless you're so committed to December 25th, or you're so committed, you know, to giving gifts, and, you know, and then it's really, you know, hey, what a cool thing. You know, I mean, because it works, it fits, and God is perfect. I mean, he doesn't do anything sloppy, you know.
No, I mean, the symmetry in the biblical narrative is astounding, despite the fact that we're talking about, what, 66 books written over, you know, 3,000 years or whatever it is. I mean, it just fits together like a glove, hand in a glove.
Listen, I was originally an atheist, and so, you know, what changed me is exactly what you're saying, is there was just nothing like the Bible, no book with the consistency, with the authority, and with prophecy that was coming true, that is coming true. I mean, that's what got me in the whole thing. God is so perfect, and, you know, every moment of his life or every big event happens according to the Hebrew prophetic calendar. In fact, we haven't gone into it, but the other part of that mystery that is that God has set up the whole age according to the Hebrew calendar, and so the beginning of the Hebrew calendar is the springtime, and that's when the first coming, all these things take place. But the other part of the Hebrew calendar is the autumn, when you have the Feast of Trumpets, and you have all these feasts that all speak about the end times. And that's why, you know, there are many believers, and I believe they're absolutely right, and that the second coming is geared to the autumn feast, trumpets, the day of the Lord, and tabernacles. So there's a whole mystery that would begin the first day of that Hebrew calendar is Nisan 1.
We don't have time. Have we touched on the Mishkan clue?
Well, the Mishkan... I didn't say what it was. The tabernacle is called in Hebrew the Mishkan.
That's the Mishkan clue.
The Mishkan, I mean, and by the way, I already, you know, so all these things like narrowing down and everything pointing to Nisan 1, and I had no idea at that moment that was already laid out by the tabernacle, which is the absolute foreshadow of the incarnation. It's the strongest one, and it actually gives a date. I didn't even know that when everything else led to it. So that was almost like icing on the cake.
Jonathan, this is fascinating. So, Jesus' birthday, Nisan 1. Again, around Easter time. Listen, when we come back, Jonathan, you'll hold on, stay with us, and we want to get an update on a story that you and I talked about several months ago, and that is the mystery of the Shemitah, which is, of course, the subject of another one of your runaway bestseller hits. The mystery of the Shemitah, the 3,000-year-old mystery that holds the secret of America's future, the world's future, and your future. And we'll get to that with Jonathan Cahn right here on The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away. Welcome back. That's Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys fame and his rather remarkable version of Hark the Herald Angels Sing. And that's from an album from 2005 called What I Really Want for Christmas. Brian Wilson, a remarkable arranger. One of the greatest, I think, of the 20th century. Jonathan Cahn is with us, and he is unraveling Bible mysteries. That's what he does best. He, the author of The Harbinger and The Mystery of the Shemitah. And we were talking about Christ's birth. We're going to get into the Shemitah. But for those interested in finding out more about the mystery of when the Messiah was really born on DVD or CD, how can they do that, Jonathan?
There's one called, a teaching called the Mishkan Clue, and there's actually even more than we could get into. But they can go to hopeoftheworld.org. That's our website, has all that and has again about probably 2,000 teachings. That these are some of them. They could just look for that, the Mishkan Clue, or anything called AD 1, 2, 3, or 4. And then also on WorldNet Daily, they also have the something called the Mishkan Clue, and again in DVD and CD. So either WorldNet Daily or our site, if they want to get in touch, hopeoftheworld.org.
All right, Jonathan, the last time you were on, we talked about your new book, The Mystery of the Shemitah, and there are some updates. It's constantly updating. But first of all, for those who missed that show and not familiar with the Shemitah, The Mystery of the Shemitah, what is it in a nutshell?
Yeah. The mystery of the Shemitah is a 3,000-year-old mystery that actually, literally, amazingly lies behind what's happening now. I would say, you know, it's birthed out of the Harbinger, and yet it's become so big. It goes back to the time of Moses, and yet it actually lies behind the rise and fall of the stock market, the rise and fall of the economy, the ascending of nations, the falling of nations, the rise of America, what may be the fall of America, even end time prophecy is so the key in so many cases is the Shemitah, and it's so specific that it actually, you know, this is what blew me away at the beginning, you know, is that it actually gives the dates of events, you know, contemporary events, things that have happened that have changed our lives, that have happened down to the day, the date, the day, the hour, the second. I mean, it's quite specific, it's quite amazing, and we are in the Shemitah now. So that's the quick nutshell. And that's what led me to, you know, I mean, it begins the Harbinger, but there was so much in it that, and because we're approaching and people are asking, that's why I wrote The Mystery of the Shemitah. I didn't plan on doing that originally, and yet as I started, so much, there was so much more. I knew it was big. I didn't realize how big it was, you know, when I started. It was just so big that, I mean, you know, it blew me away. And when I get blown away, I know there's something good going on.
Well, I'll tell you someone else who's blown away. You've really captured the attention of Glenn Beck from Fox. He's all over this. I mean, he's talking about The Mystery of the Shemitah to anyone who'll listen. I mean, you really... Yeah. Captured his imagination.
Yeah, it's interesting. I first, you know, I was on Glenn Beck a while back, and when I was at the Harbinger, and so I mentioned it, but he didn't catch it then. And then I've been getting, you know, continual reports that he's been talking about it continuously, and wants to he wants me actually to do a whole program on it. So yeah, I mean it's listen again. I mean you know, I think maybe Richard, one of the reasons why the Lord, it says he uses the foolish things to confound the wise, and you know, here the unlikely things. Well, I was an atheist, so I need things like heavy, you know, things to do it, to make me. So when I'm blown away, that's how the Harbinger started, and that's how this started. But it's exact. I mean, you know, for so many years, you know, financial analysts have been like, they've been mystified. Why do all these great crashes happen on this one time of the year? Well, the answer is in the Bible, because this is the exact time that God ordained in the Bible for financial, literally, wipeout. And for those who don't know, in a nutshell, the Shemitah means it's the Sabbath year. You know, what happened is just there was a Sabbath day. Every seventh day was a Sabbath day. Every seventh year is the Sabbath year. And basically what it meant was that for an entire year, there was no sowing, no reaping, no working of the land. The land rests, and on the, no buying or selling of the fruits of the land. The last day, something quite extraordinary happens. All credit is wiped out. All debts are wiped out. The financial accounts of the nation are literally wiped clean. That day is called Elul 29, or the 29th day of the Hebrew month, Elul. That's the wipeout day. Well, the amazing thing is that this mystery is still in effect. And, you know, what happened is when Israel turned away from God, the Shemitah, instead of being a blessing, turns into a sign of judgment on a nation or a civilization that has turned away from God, is driving him out of its life, and it comes back like with a vengeance, literally to strike the financial realm of the nation, it strikes the economic realm, and it even can strike the existence of the nation itself. So one of the things that I've seen, and this is, you know, it started with the harbinger, but then what happened was, you know, I saw that it not only, it didn't begin with 9/11. This thing has been happening. This mystery has been affecting our lives from the moment we were born. And just to give an example, we won't.
Let me get you to hold on to that. We'll give that example when we come back. Jonathan Kahn is with us. The mystery of the Shemitah, right here on the Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. Hang around for a while, won't you? That's the Brian Seltzer Orchestra and Boogie Woogie Santa. Jonathan Kahn is with us, Hope of the World Ministries, and we're talking about the mystery of the Shemitah, continuing signs that we are headed into some pretty rough waters. And now, you mentioned the rise and the fall of the stock market in our economy. Let's draw some parallels. Let's go back to, for example, 2007 and loan catastrophe.
Yeah.
Does that time out?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that if you look at the last 40 years, you have five major long-term collapses of the stock market, and every single one of them happens at a seven-year cycle to the one before, the one after, which is the Shemitah. That's what happens. Not only that, every single one of them happens in the year of the biblical Shemitah, the year appointed to wipe out every single one. And then when you get to the last two, it's as if this phenomenon is increasing in intensity, it's getting stronger, and I would link that to America and also other nations turning away from God, because this is how it gets stronger. But here's what happens is, in 2001, one of the last Shemitah was 2000 to 2001, and then 2007 to 2008. The last week of the Shemitah in 2001, comes 9/11.
Right.
9/11 causes, 1 week later, the greatest collapse in Wall Street history up to that day. That greatest collapse happens on Elul 29, the exact day appointed of the Shemitah by God to wipe out the nation's account, and particularly to strike a civilization that is driving God out of its life. On the exact day, down to the hours, is the greatest wipeout. Well, that record lasts for 7 years. And then you have finally it's topped in the great collapse, the great recession. Well, the greatest day of the great recession was September 29th, 2008. Comes the greatest collapse. It's so great. I mean, even when it's weird too, because when they go to the stock market that morning, they ring the bell. The bell refuses to ring that day. Even they take it as a sign. Greatest collapse. When does the greatest collapse take place? On Elul 29, the exact same biblical day appointed 3,000 years before to wipe out financial accounts. So the two greatest collapses up to those days each happen on the exact same biblical day. They're separated, according to the mystery of the Shemitah, these crashes will be separated by 7 years. They're separated by seven biblical years down to the day, down to the hour, down to the second. And not only, you know, is it on Elul 29, but there's only one Elul 29 in 7 years that could actually be the actual wipeout day. And each one takes place on the one in 7 year day, the actual one. This mystery, Richard, has been affecting our lives. I mean, in these ways, affected the world's financial markets, the economy, And even, again, we probably won't get into it, but even the rise of nation, the rise of America, the years of America begins its rise to superpower, the year of the Shemitah. It reaches its peak in the year of the Shemitah, 1945. When the Shemitah comes at certain times, it often means the shaking of nations, and it can mean the rise or fall of nations. Now, I'll tell you just a little bit of what, you know, what is some things that have happened since we talked, you know, and I'm not dogmatic that God has to do it, you know, and the you know, God's not going to fit in our boxes, you know, and, you know, he doesn't have, not every cycle of the Shemitah does it have to be the same thing. But I would be aware of it. So having, giving that caveat that, you know, we're not date setting, even though there are dates in the book and, we can mention some dates, but the point is that it doesn't have to, but here's what happened. In the last two Shemitahs, which is, again, 2001 and 2001 and then 2007 and 8, when the Shemitah began, I mean, you had a foreshadow of what was going to happen at the end. The most dramatic thing happens at the end on that last day, that Elul 29 day. That's the last day of the Shemitah. But when it opens, the last two times, there have been foreshadows at the beginning that something was coming at the end. Example, in 2007, when the Shemitah began, that same day comes the first bank collapse, like 100-something years, happens in Great Britain. It's called Northern Rock, collapses on the day of the Shemitah, which is a foreshadow of what's at the end of the Shemitah. You're going to have banks collapsing all over the world. And within a month of the Shemitah beginning in 2007, the stock market that had been rising for years suddenly starts turning down, and then will begin to, it's gradual at first, but by the end of the Shemitah, it's the greatest collapse since the Great Depression.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but again, you know, we're talking about these 7 years, September 29th, 2008, I believe the stock market fell by 777 points.
Yes, on the day of sevens, the biblical day of crown that crowns the seventh year, the end of the 7 year cycle, the stock market falls on the day of the appointed by God to crash is 777 points. How much was wiped out? How much percentage? 7% was wiped out. How many hours? It took 7 hours to wipe it out. I mean, there's so much. And the one before it in 2001, right after September 11th. Crashes, how much is wiped out? 7%. I mean, so absolutely, absolutely. And there's a whole thing we can go into, we won't, but that if you go back from that day of that crash, you go to the moment of that 777 appears in Wall Street. If you go back 7 years from that 777, seven years and 7 days and 7 hours, it brings you to the day of 9/11, to the hour of the attack. But we will not go into that. But the other thing is that you know, we are now in the next one. It just began. The major part is going to be this coming year, 2015. So has there been any foreshadow at the beginning of what may possibly take place as we head towards the end? Well, the interesting thing is, you know, the month, or actually the week of September 23rd to the 26th, from Monday to Friday, on that week, all of a sudden, Wall Street gets unhinged. It starts reeling. I mean, people start talking about, is this another crash from that happened in 2007?
But it bounced back.
Yeah, it's back. But is it with the same thing happened in 2007? What happened is you had a foreshadow right away. And then you had, it didn't look like something was going to happen, and then it happened at the end. So could have been a foreshadow. Well, that reeling of the stock market, it went about for 3 weeks, began the week that the Shemitah began, and it also, the greatest crash day was the day of the Shemitah on that thing. Now, another kind of mystery in the book, it's called The Mystery of the Towers, is that when a nation puts up the highest towers on earth, that's often linked to the rise of that nation, or it can be linked when a tower falls, can be linked to the fall of a nation.
Well, the hubris, right.
Yeah, well, when America, you know, America put up the highest tower on earth for the first time, and it was the first great skyscraper in the world. For the first time, the highest secular building was not in Europe, but was in America. It was 1870. The next year, America becomes the greatest economic power on earth. The next year, the tower marks the beginning of the Gilded Age of America. So it marks the rise of America. Well, America has been putting up the highest towers ever since. And so ever since, until just before 9/11, all of a sudden, America is surpassed by Asia. And then comes 9/11 when America's tower, representing, you know, the preeminence, the glory of America, crashes. Well, I've been warning, you know, for quite a while with the Harbinger and with now with the Shemitah, but before that, the Harbinger, that one of the first signs that America doesn't get right, get back with God, one of the warnings of the Harbinger and the warning of the Shemitah is that its crown as the head of nations will be removed. And I've said it for a long time. Well, here's something. Within the first month of the Shemitah, that is September, October, first month of that Shemitah, America, the age of America from 1871, the age of America being the strongest economic power on earth, has come to an end.
They were overtaken by China. That's right.
That's right. And it happened just as the Shemitah began. And it's the same nation that is now putting up higher towers than America, by the way. But and that happened that the first week of the Shemitah, America was surpassed by Russia in its nuclear capability, in its military. So you got the military, you have economic, and you have, I mean, the crown that America has worn. This is the beginning of the end of the American age as we know it. And remember, Richard, I shared this once with you, that the Shemitah, it literally in Hebrew, people take it as meaning the release, and it is the release. But Hebrew, it also means the collapse or the fall or the shaking. And it literally can speak also of, it means to let collapse. And on each of these days of the Shemitah, the last two, you literally had the letting collapse of America's economic, you know, power. But now you're watching the literal, the American age begin to collapse. Now, it begins with the Shemitah, but then on top of that, you have something else. On top of that, that on the actual day of the Shemitah, I said you had the greatest crash of that began this teetering of Wall Street for about 3 weeks. But then you also had an earthquake on that day, over six of the Richter scale on the day of the Shemitah. Could that be a foreshadow? And you, by the way, you know, when we talk about Ebola and this, you know, the plague and pestilence, the first sign of Ebola, and again, we're just talking about foreshadows, happened on the day of the Shemitah. All this happened on the first day of the Shemitah. Every single one of them happened that same day. And the other thing is that the harbingers linked to this are continuing and continuing. One of the things is I've talked about is the tower, you know, because we mentioned that. And, you know, the tower, the World Trade Center, was conceived in the year of the Shemitah. It was begun to its construction in the year of the Shemitah. It took 7 years. The 7 years of the Shemitah was finished. It's 1973, year of the Shemitah, was destroyed in the year of the Shemitah. Well, this new tower was conceived in the year of the Shemitah, and it looks like it's going to be finished. It hasn't been dedicated yet. They opened its doors. It hasn't been dedicated in the year of the Shemitah. And I would keep my eyes on that tower, number one. It's one of the four, it's one of the nine harbingers in the Harbinger, and there's been so much attached to that, linked to this warning of judgment. It's not a good sign. You know, the President of the United States actually inscribed on that tower the paraphrase of Isaiah 9:10, which is the pronouncement of judgment on the nation. That's the Harbinger scripture. It's on the top floor of that tower. And that tower, I don't know if you heard it, just about,
yes,
it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, the story came out that tower is now overrun with rats. Not a good sign. You know, it happened just as that thing there. But the other thing is that, you know, the Shemitah is, you know, it always leads to the finale. Now, when is the finale going to take place? And again, I'm not saying it has to happen, but your listeners should know that the day of wipeout comes. It's Elul 29 is September 13th of 2015, and on that day, you know, one of the signs in the Bible of judgment. I'm not saying every time, but one of the signs is that of the darkening of the sun. It's, you see it in the prophets. Well, the day of September 13th will also be the darkening of the sun, will be a solar eclipse. And the last time there was a solar eclipse on Elul 29, the day of the Shemitah, the wipeout day, that you had the greatest, it led into the greatest collapse in Wall Street history percentage-wise, which was Black Monday, 1987. And now it's happening again. But I would be prepared, is what I was saying. That I believe a great shaking, I'll say regardless of time, a great shaking is coming to America and the world. And I believe this shaking will affect the financial realm, will affect the economic realm, and will be greater than any of those realms. And there may even be an event that triggers it, as with 9/11. And it's interesting because September 13th this year is not on a stock market day. It's a Sunday. So it would seem to point, if there is something to happen then, that it would be something even beyond the economic realm. But regardless of whether it happens at this wipeout time of the Shemitah or happens after that, I believe very strongly, and this is the warnings of the harbingers, which are still continuing to come true, and the Shemitah, that a great shaking is coming and we need to be ready.
Jonathan, where can people get, more information on the mystery of the Shemitah and the Harbinger?
The Mystery of the Shemitah is available everywhere, and the Harbinger, everywhere where books are. They can get online from Amazon or offline, you know, Walmart, everywhere. Everywhere there are books, online or off, you can get the Harbinger and the Mystery of the Shemitah.
Jonathan, always a pleasure, and a very blessed Merry Christmas to you.
You too, Richard. God bless you.
Jonathan Kahn. My website, richardserrett.com. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. And as always, follow the truth. Hey, thanks for inviting me into your home and between your ears. Merry Christmas to all of you listening in on our flagship station, AM 740, Zoomer Radio here in Toronto. And again, all of you listening in on the podcast. Also to the live stream at zoomerradio.ca or talkzone.com. And of course, all of you listening in on one of our growing list of U.S. affiliates. Again, my wish to you and yours, a blessed Christmas and a happy Hanukkah and a peaceful, healthy, prosperous new year. Once again, we're doing another HOA Hangout on Air. And if you want to join the Hangout, just go to my Twitter feed, at Richard Serrett. And while you're there, you can follow me, say hi. But if you go to the first or second tweets from the top, you'll find the link for our live YouTube stream. And then you can listen and watch the program at the same time. You can even check out my new haircut. Give me a thumbs up or thumbs down. I'm also wearing my a festive T-shirt. Well, not really. It's black and it's, well, a few James Bond fans, you'll understand. It's a Spectre on it, and it has the symbol of Spectre, the octopus. Can they see that? Albert, my story producer? Lower the camera there. That's my Spectre T-shirt. All right. If you can tell me what Spectre stands for, there's no prize. I just, you know, congratulations. You can drop me a line at theconspiracyshow1@gmail.com. What does Spectre stand for? There's a new James Bond film being made as we speak. Daniel Craig returning as James Bond, and the name of it is Spectre. So I'm wearing this not-so-festive T-shirt, I guess, in commemoration of the new James Bond film. All right. I wanted to mention that towards the tail end of the program, I mean right near the finish line, just before we dim the lights, our media science contributor Nelson Thaw will be here for a very quick call to give us a few insights into this whole Sony Pictures computer hacking story involving the North Koreans, or so we're led to believe. We're led to believe that it's the North Koreans that are doing this, but we'll find out what Nelson makes of all of this. That's later in the hour. I know many of you are all hunkering down for the Christmas season and you're starting to slow things down, but the Conspiracy Show doesn't stop for Christmas. And this hour, well, admittedly, it has very little to do with Christmas, although my technical producer, Tim Spreen, is going to spin a few of my holiday favorites just to keep us in the mood. But where we're headed in the next 45 minutes or so, it's about as far as Christmas as you can get. It has to do with some recently uncovered information regarding the Nazis and anti-gravitic technology. Now, many of you are no doubt familiar with the legend of the Nazi Bell, which was purported to be a top-secret Nazi scientific technological device, secret weapon, or Wunderwaffe. Author Joseph Farrell, who's a great friend of this program, has written about it extensively, the Nazi Bell, and it's associated with Nazi occultism and anti-gravity and free energy. Now, here with the latest on this fascinating secret chapter in history is George Freund, who has previously hosted his own popular talk show on that channel, delving into such issues as the debt crisis, 9/11, secret weather weapons, all things hidden. And his also popular podcast was known as the Conspiracy Cafe, an alternative media forum that challenges popular opinion with difficult truths. And as a student with a passion for the intelligence history of the world, events can be applied to those students with a can be applied to those dictums. Those who don't know their history are condemned to repeat it. If there's anything learned from history, it's people learning nothing from history. George Freund, how are you? Merry Christmas, my friend.
And Merry Christmas to you. Actually, listening to your previous guest, the 777, I saw that in the window of the Sydney coffee shop. That was a giant close-up, went around the world. So I don't know, there was some predictive programming going on there by the powers to be to tell us that the Shemitah is in play.
Ah, interesting.
I was looking at the numbers. It was got to have some significance, and I'm glad he enlightened us into that, because that is the significance.
Let's talk about – I received this it's not entirely cryptic, but it certainly, you know, grabbed my attention, this email from you that you just recently uncovered information regarding Nazi secret technology and secret weapons and so forth that they were developing even before the Second World War. Tell us about how this evolved.
Well, accidentally, I was just looking for a video to put on my website about sunken German submarines. And I stumbled across a link that said one was sunk off the coast of New Zealand. I was just flabbergasted because I never heard about that before. That was the U-196.
So right, right.
Allegedly, it was found in 1981, and everyone was aghast. Like, you know, where did the crew go? What happened? And slowly it was pieced together that the crew was taken ashore and instantly assimilated into society, and allowed to ultimately get status in New Zealand, and they had a cargo, and that cargo involved nuclear technology and the ability to process nuclear technology so the British could make their own bomb, because they weren't getting much help from the Americans with their captured Operation Paperclip Nazis. So everybody was competing for everything all at the same time, the French, the British, the Russians, and the Americans, and because they had access to get at these bells, and pretty much each one of these countries did. So near the end of the war, Germany surrendered on May the 8th, 1945, and they sent the...
The German army did, but the Nazis never did.
They never did, and I would argue today that we can follow this right to the White House today. That's how bizarre this story can be.
Wow. Well, you mentioned the U-196, and these were long-range U-boats. As you say, one was sunk off the coast of New Zealand. Now, was there not another one sent to New York Harbor in something like May of 1945, and that was also carrying weapons-grade uranium?
Yes, it was. That was U-234. It was supposed to go to Japan, and then with the war closing in, that was one of the deals that got a lot of the really high-level Nazis off the hook, is you had to have something to trade for anonymity and freedom, and nuclear weapons is the ultimate one. And even, if you look back with 2020 hindsight to say who got off, if an evil power got a hold of these weapons and had mastery of them, or someone who would want to be an evil power, it's over. The world is going to be completely changed, and the highest levels of the Third Reich could sell that for their freedom, to say, you let me go, and we'll give you technology.
So in other words, Hitler's successor, this admiral, ordered all of these secret submarine flotilla to sail to all these designated enemy ports. One was in New Zealand. One ended up being in New York Harbor, but you say that was en route to Japan. And in exchange for this nuclear material on board, Germany gained its sort of continued participation in any post-war nuclear weapons programs.
Oh, very much so. The Americans were having a lot of trouble putting the nuclear bomb together. A lot of trouble. And when U-234 came in, it was just a matter of weeks before they started to really get it rolling. One, they had the uranium. Two, they had the triggers, the detonators to get the bomb going. And the head of security for the Manhattan Project just flipped when he saw the treasure trove that came with the submarine, as well as technical advice. And that's what really made the American nuclear bomb work. And U-234 was one of the submarines. There was, I don't know if you're familiar with the Humphrey Bogart film, the Across the Pacific movie. That was just a classic bogey movie.
I haven't seen that one, no.
There's a secret base that the Japanese are supposed to have around the Panama Canal, and all the Nazis and fascist agents and such get around there. And, of course, Bogart goes in and cleans it out. But there was a real one. and it was in Indonesia. It was on a tea plantation, and it belonged to two brothers, Emil and Theodore Helfrich. And Mr. Helfrich was the CEO of Hamburg America Line. He was also CEO of Esso, which was owned by Standard Oil at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one who told Hindenburg that you've got to put Hitler in power. He was also friends of, they call it the Friends of the Friendship Circle of Himmler. He was a member of that along with Halsmar Schacht, the banker, and the people from the Abernabe, the people that went to Tibet and Antarctica, the far-off places to look for secret technology and to be able to get into the inner earth theory of the world and portals
right.
and such like that.
What about this base that was the submarine, Nazi submarine base in the Antarctic?
Well, that's where it leads to ultimately. From Indonesia, U-196 sailed. It was written off because it didn't report in around December the 1st, 1944, and they just said it was lost at sea, but no one's ever discovered the wreck, or it was just because it didn't report in, it was written off. And ultimately, it sailed into the waters of New Zealand. There's other reports as well that previously it was carrying gold. That's what the Germans and Japanese would trade science and technology for gold, because Germany was in a financial crisis, not having any foreign currency reserves to buy things and support its country. So these special submarines were designed. They were the 9CD types, larger. They were cleaned out of weapons. Their job was to just basically be an underwater freighter and carry the technology and the basically assets, the gold assets around the world.
Right, all the Nazi plunder. I mean, and priceless works of art and gold and silver and unimaginable wealth. So this was all stored somewhere in the Antarctic. Is that the idea?
Ultimately, that's where it went to. The story of the Antarctic is just absolutely bizarre, and you're probably familiar with Operation High Jump, where Admiral Byrd, after the war, basically did an invasion of Antarctica coming from three directions with an aircraft carrier task force, allegedly just to go looking for some sort of mapping expedition. But none of the vessels he was taking, there isn't much you could do with an American combat submarine, some destroyers. They really aren't exploration vehicles. And the storyline is that they invaded Antarctica looking for this Nazi redoubt and any advanced civilizations or technologies that may exist. And I sent you a movie that was found in the an antique store in Germany, something that just slipped through, that wasn't ever accumulated or destroyed. It was the German expedition to go to Antarctica, and it's just absolutely stunning to watch this movie. It's a silent film, and it just details in every little way what was found there. So
all right, George,
the Deutsche Antarctic Expedition of 1938.
All right, George, hold on. We'll take a timeout. We'll come back as Willie Nelson takes us into the break with Pretty Paper. We'll continue to discuss Nazi secret technology, secret weaponry, and the Nazi bell with George Freund, independent researcher, broadcaster, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. Welcome back. George Freund is with us, George was, for a number of years, the host of a very popular podcast, the Conspiracy Cafe. Is that still going, George?
Yes, I just do it from home now because the technology exists that, I just record things at home and post them on my website, and it saves me trucking down to the studio. But, we still have a massive following, and, people just beg me to keep going because I do things that nobody else will do, like take the bull by the horns and damn the torpedoes full speed ahead. There's a lot of things that need to be said, and a lot of people just aren't prepared to say it, and once you get used to taking the Kool-Aid, you can't get off it.
Now, we were talking about this nuclear technology that the Germans, the Nazis possessed, and after Hitler's death in the dying days of the Second World War, at least the Second World War in Europe, Hitler's appointed successor, this admiral, ordered this flotilla of long-range subs that were loaded with this nuclear technology to sail off to these designated ports, enemy ports, really, New Zealand, New York, perhaps en route to Japan. What specifically, then, we're talking about weapons-grade plutonium, I guess, here. So the takeaway here is what? That the Germans were just very close, within a hair's width of developing the bomb before the Americans.
I believe so. I think they were, to the point, you could be getting to a matter of days. There might just been some Germans on the inside realizing it would probably be better to give it to the Americans overall than to let the enemy side take it. What the Germans really did with this Bell is the Bell was a heavy particle accelerator.
Yeah, we need to talk about the Nazi Bell.
And what it did is it was a source for creating some artificial neutrons for an element called protactinium-233, and it was made from thorium-232. And when you use this Bell, which is just two bells inside each other that spin at a very high rate of speed in opposite directions and create a vacuum inside, and mercury would be put inside with thorium gas. And this would, basically, without using a nuclear reactor, create a fissionable material that you could have, bomb-grade material, by using thorium and turning it into uranium. In 27 days, this new to me, but protactinium-233 would change into uranium-233. And it was an electrical device, sort of using Tesla technology, to pump in close to 5 million volts into this device with the, what's termed red mercury, this gas in between. And it is supposed to have very bizarre effects. It had it was a ceramic Bell, this Bell, and it would glow like a ultraviolet color when it was in full operation. And, that just must be stunning to imagine. And it was made from ceramics. It had a beryllium mirror on it to reflect the neutrons back in so that, I guess you don't lose any energy out of it. And people said when you looked at this concave mirror that you would actually see, like, back in time, that it was, such a bizarre encounter. These details did come out in the Nuremberg trials. One of the head Gestapo generals who was in charge of this program talked quite a bit about this, and other German scientists were taped at a British university while they were, in quasi-custody working for them, that they had this ability to create fissionable materials without using nuclear reactors. And this has been shut up and basically taken away from history. Another place one of these Bells went was to Argentina. So there was a liaison with the Chilean Navy, which is just so close to Argentina, where one of these submarines came ashore. And it's quite common knowledge. I think it was Dr. Richter, the man who invented the Richter scale, who brought a Bell into Argentina. It was used. And the Americans went after Mr. Juan Perón viciously to try to get control of that technology and shut them down. And Argentina was not in the good books through that period of time because these weapons were so powerful. The whole concept even of red mercury, as I was doing research into that, is it has been patented by DuPont. They make a liquid explosive, HG2SB207. A military code name for this explosive that's just, it's almost as powerful as a nuclear weapon.
Is that Zerum-525?
Well, the Zerum-525 is the material they put inside the two rotating spheres. So there's a paraffin material, there is a plasma created from the mercury and the thorium vapors, and that whole piece is called the Zerum-525, and that acts as a means of creating free neutrons to bombard the thorium-232 and turn it into this protactinium.
So you mentioned some of the strange effects that were produced by the Nazi Bell. First of all, how many Nazi Bells were in existence or are in existence? Do we know?
The best I can come up with, you know, from one of the best research articles I found, is they could determine there were four, but there very, very well may have been more. The Russians got one by working with a another chap and on one of the other German scientists, and they made their own. But there were four altogether, that, you know, one for the French, one for the Americans, one for the British. And, you know, this is using the centrifuge method. The Americans weren't getting anywhere, and we can see in the modern era that the Iranians aren't really getting anywhere using the centrifuge either. And this technology was so advanced, and it's still hush-hush up today. So this is like the shortcut of just making your fissionable materials to make your weapons, and that might had to be used underground too, because it gave off a massive amount of X-ray radiation.
Right. Yeah, and there were a number of unnamed scientists, apparently Nazi scientists, who died.
Yes.
And according to Joseph Farrell and others, the Nazis ended up killing 60 scientists, Nazi scientists that were associated with the program, and then they buried them in a mass grave just to keep – it sort of almost mirrors the you know, the death list of all these microbiologists going around the world.
Correct. So, you know, Hitler was a sore loser, to say the least. In you know, one of the important things about this base in Indonesia is there's a book out called Ratline, Soviet Spies, Nazi Priests. And this is probably one of the, you know, one of the books you read that your eyeballs pop out of your head, because he alleges ultimately that Hitler was transferred to Indonesia and lived in the vicinity of this base, and that he died there. And that's a very significant and very important piece of information. And I have quite a blog on my website about that, because we all know there was a certain president who was documented to live in Indonesia and be possibly born in Indonesia. And there was a great deal of controversy about where he was born. And his mother worked for USAID, and a doctor on a USAID ship called the SS Hope is the man who said that he saw Hitler in his old age in the early 1960s when he was working on that ship as a charity doctor. And let me get his name there, Dr. Sosto Husada.
Well, that's interesting, because recently declassified FBI files seem to strongly suggest that Hitler did survive the Second World War and perhaps lived in Argentina. But you're saying Indonesia. Maybe that's just a smokescreen.
Well, that was a transshipment point. First it was Argentina, and then ultimately in you know, the latter years, Indonesia. And like I say, it's just very, very interesting that the most controversial president we have about you know, having identification to say, like, if I wanted to clean in the White House, I'm going to need lots of pieces of ID, and they're going to have to stand up. And, you know, Barry Satoros just don't. And a lot of the things, you know, seem to be finagled. So the fact that his mother is working in the same area where allegedly Mr. Hitler was, on a ship called Hope, his campaign slogan and promise, Hope, is
interesting.
Just absolutely mind-boggling that we have him there. And, you know, I would say that if he was a Manchurian-style president, he may have been very well put together to take that office on purpose to lead America down a darker trail. You talked about, you know, these buildings with your previous guest about the World Trade Center and the towers. China has made a replica city of Manhattan, you know, era 2001. They've rebuilt the World Trade Centers in this replica. It's an exact scale model. And so the World Trade Centers are standing in China right now. And, you know, that's just an eerie significance to the Shemitah coming along.
Yes.
And the significance of these towers and the banking empire, or the survivor of the Shemitah maybe being China, because they seem to be in the strongest position holding the American debt.
George Freund is with us, the host of Conspiracy Cafe, independent researcher, and we're talking about secret Nazi secret weapons. Now, let's get back to the Nazi bell for a moment and these strange effects. And you mentioned, you hinted that when people peered into the Nazi bell, it's like they got a glimpse of the past. So What are we saying here, that this thing was capable of producing a time travel effect?
It's like opening a portal or a window. We can only speculate because, you know, we can't see this. We can only just listen to secondhand observations. But we're dealing with powers that are so great that, you know, almost anything is possible. And just to give you an example of how important Antarctica is as a base, like, I don't know if you're familiar with the fact that there was an expedition there in 2007 by someone who you will probably know very, very well, not personally, but just by reputation, is, you know, Mr. Paul Allen from Microsoft.
Ah, yes.
Now, he bought several hundred million dollar yacht and then automatically decided not to use it and built another one called the Octopus. And the Octopus is 416 feet long and its bottom comes open, just like you'd see in the James Bond film. And he's got several hundred million dollar submarine that holds 10 people that comes out of the bottom. And he went on an expedition to Antarctica in 2007 with a private security force of former Navy SEALs for protection to, you know, who knows what. But you could rent your own ship probably very cheaply,
right,
compared to building the Octopus.
It's fascinating you mentioned the Octopus because for no particular reason tonight I decided to don my Spectre T-shirt, which of course has the Octopus on it. I don't know if people at home can see this on the webcam on our Hangout. Oh, and incidentally, I should mention, George, your webcam is not operating. We can't see you.
Okay, well, I can see me, so it's... Oh. You know, I'm there, and then the streaming going out on my internet I can look at is I'm,
Excellent.
Pushing up a lot of speed here, so why it's not getting out there, I can't understand.
And well, maybe it's just on our end we're not seeing you, so hopefully it is getting out there. In any event, I thought that was an interesting little serendipity there that I'd be wearing the Spectre T-shirt. All right, so any idea, do you want to speculate as to what Alan was looking for? I mean, is there still... Nazi plunder is there a Nazi bell in the Antarctic?
I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised that there was a base. They called it Base 211 in this film from 1938. And when you look at the pictures of this base, it is just mind-boggling that these were actual film footage of things they did there. Like, they had tunnels going underground that looked like you could take the subway down.
Right.
And so do these things still exist in present time? The conspiracy word that you're not afraid to use and the one I haven't been afraid to use is I take power from it because I use it as a joke when some global TV reporters were teasing me once, coming home a bit drunk, talking about the conspiracy word. And I said, well, you know what the first conspiracy was, don't you? And they just, you know, looked at me and I said, the world is round. That was the first conspiracy. And anyone who thought it was round was wacko, and the church and the state were pretty much telling you it's flat, it has to be flat. And when we get into advanced civilizations, or maybe ancient civilizations, if there's something under the Antarctic ice, and many people say they are, the Russians captured German top secret documents showing the inner Earth in map form and access points. And I have a Russian documentary on my website. If you just type in the search engine in the video section, Antarctica, you'll see them all. I have, you know, Admiral
the Hollow
Bird's
Earth
video, the Russian video.
Well, you mentioned Admiral Byrd earlier, and of course, Admiral Byrd, according to this legendary journal, and some say that this story is apocryphal, that no such journal exists, but Byrd talks about catching a glimpse of an opening as he flew over the South Pole, suddenly looking down and seeing this verdant landscape, almost tropical, which he flew into, again, in the middle of where there should be nothing but ice and snow, and saw a tropical flora and creatures, strange creatures and so forth. So
that's quite correct. And in the South American press at the time, he said there were flying saucers there.
Well, I want to ask you this, and we're coming up on a break, George, but I want to talk about the connection between the Nazi bell and anti-gravity and Nazi flying saucers, Nazi UFOs. Would you be good for that?
Sure.
George Freund joins us from Conspiracy Cafe. And just a reminder, coming up a little bit later, we'll talk about the Sony Pictures North Korean computer hacking story from our media scientist friend Nelson Thal. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show, our Christmas edition. Stay with us. Welcome back. And just a reminder, we are doing another one of our Hangouts on Air, HOAs. And if you go to my Twitter feed, at Richard Serrett, right near the top of the feed is the link. You just click on that. And I'm not sure if you're able to see George Freund, our guest from the Conspiracy Cafe. You can see me in my new haircut, if you'd like. Anyway, we're in the early stages of developing the HOA, and we wish to continue to do these. If you'd like to give us a comment or two about how you're enjoying the HOA, just send us an email. It's theconspiracyshow1@gmail.com. Theconspiracyshow1@gmail.com. In fact, if you just would like to email us on any matter, that would be a great way to contact us. theconspiracyshow1@gmail.com. George Freund is with us talking about the Nazi bell, anti-gravitics, secret weaponry that the Nazis possessed. Just a reminder, coming up near the top of the hour, Nelson Thal, our media scientist friend, will be with us to share some interesting details, an interesting angle on this whole Sony Pictures North Korea computer hacking story. It may not be what it appears, but then again, what is? George, I'm wondering, what is the connection, do you suppose, between this Nazi bell technology that the Germans apparently were using to enrich nuclear material? What is the connection between the Nazi bell and, you know, these stories of Foo Fighters that Allied pilots encountered, what we now call, you know, flying saucers or UFOs? Back then they referred to them as Foo Fighters, because the timing is interesting. You know, 1947, of course, just after the war, we have Roswell. And some contend, there are those who suggest that what the Jim Mars, I believe, among them, that what the what was actually shot down near Corona, New Mexico, was not an extraterrestrial craft. It was a Nazi craft. But how do you tell the American people, the public, you know, that they're still engaged in a war against the Nazis when the war wrapped up 2 years ago? And then, of course, you have the Kenneth Arnold flying saucer sightings in 1947. So what is the connection between the Nazi bell, Foo Fighters, UFOs?
Well, if they did have a base there, and some of the reference material that's coming out now is there were a people there who had Germanic appearance, spoke German, but seemed to be very, very far advanced technologically compared to the rest of us, and that they were operating these craft. And there was research in Germany with basically the typical disc shape of aircraft using something called the Coanda effect, where hot vapor or air is pushed along the outside of the craft, goes underneath and gives it lift. We used to have an experimental craft here in Malton in our own aircraft industry post-war playing with that. The craft would get up from the ground, but it was hardly anything that could travel, like Admiral Byrd said. He was quoted in the various South American press that this thing could go pole to pole in minutes, and that he was concerned of a potential attack on the United States. And so he took this very, very seriously. And, there was also a component to say that there is an alien race as well that had this type of technology, but definitely a Germanic-speaking people. So if this bell did have a potential for something to do with time, could these Germanic, Earth-like-looking people have been someone from the future with, advanced technologies or something along that line?
This story just gets weirder and weirder, doesn't it?
Well, when we look at what happened back in the time, is Admiral Byrd, after his second operation, Operation Deep Freeze, died. And there's a lot of people who thought he was murdered. And, worse than that is James Forrestal, the Secretary of Defense, was most definitely murdered. So they wrote him off as a suicide. He was said to be nuts because he started talking about what we're talking about.
Well, they slipped him some LSD, I believe, and threw him out of
him out the window.
Right.
He was in the presidential suite at Bethesda Naval Hospital. His family had told him, what was to try to get him out. He was on the eve of the day where a court order was to have him released. He was, of course, committed without his consent. and his family got him out. And on that evening, he was approached by, I guess, the big burly guys that look after you in these places. And what I found from an old newspaper article was there were scratch marks on the windowsill. Well, if you're jumping out, you just jump. You know, there's no scratch marks.
That's right.
If so, somebody's throwing you out, there's going to be scratch marks. So the fact that he had the information about the top-end weapon systems and the ability of, you know, whatever these spacecraft are, and the fact that he was losing it and he wasn't going to keep it a secret anymore, his life was over. He was taken out. Yes, they named an aircraft carrier after him later, but he's gone. And so is Bird.
This suggests that, I mean, we've heard tales of this huge tract of land in Argentina that was purchased by essentially the what Joseph Farrow calls the Nazi International, this huge conglomerate. Again, the Nazis didn't lose the war. The German army surrendered. The Nazis never did. And so they simply moved their base of operation from Germany to wherever. So, I mean, this is 70 years ago, this technology, the Nazi Bell.
Patents or works on this material, you know, was starting in 1922. They were just so far and away advanced compared to everybody else. I don't know. You're familiar with the Rosenbergs?
Yes.
Okay, this is one of the little footnotes in this article I was looking at. The most spectacular legal case of the 20th century, the atomic espionage trials. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg spoke of warships of space.
Interesting.
To go that far back, and what we think are, you know, basically a little bit advanced from the horse and buggy days, to see people persecuted with this knowledge, because it was just, you're walking into a kangaroo court where you're going to be executed, and most likely for the knowledge that you possess.
Right. Warships of space, yeah. And then we move ahead 80 years, and now we have Gary McKinnon. In England, of course, hacking into Pentagon computers and talking about this secret space program. It's all starting to line up. We'll stay connected here with George Freund here for a few moments yet. And then, as I say, coming up a little bit later in the hour, Nelson Thal, our media scientist, talking about the Sony Pictures North Korea computer hacking story, not what it appears. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us. George Freund from Conspiracy Cafe stays with us for a few moments yet. Now, George, you mentioned that you felt like a kid in the candy store, sort of uncovering this information that it just seemed to be available online, and then it was almost as quickly taken down. What do you mean by that?
Well, what happened to me was when I first found these articles from a New Zealand newspaper about the U-196, you know, I saved everything. I stayed up late, copied it all, saved all the pictures and images, and then, you know, kept the links, and then when I went to open them the next day, they were gone. And I was just flabbergasted to say, well, hey, that was fast. But, you know, they have been restored, it appears, but when I went the next day, they were gone.
Interesting. Now, let me throw something else at you, and that is we're all familiar with the legend of the Philadelphia experiment and the USS Eldridge. Where some suggested that there was a bit of time travel involved there, that some sort of Tesla coil that was mounted on this this naval it wasn't a destroyer, it was a ship that would accompany a naval destroyer, but it suddenly sort of blipped in and out of reality. Do you think there's a connection there with the Nazi Bell? Could there have been a Nazi Bell on board the USS Eldridge?
Well, what, as I understand it, they did is they put large copper coils around it and synthesized basically a massive Tesla coil. There could have been a bell on the inside, but, you know, we can only speculate about that. And that's what caused this this rupture in time and space to have it move. And, of course, they hide everything. One of the large UFO incidents that goes back to 1965 that fits the Bell scenario is the Kecksburg UFO incident.
In Pennsylvania, yes.
And so they call it an acorn, but it bears a great deal of significance to the shape and design of this bell. And that's one of the other theories that comes out of the Flat Earth Society, is that these things were craft as well, that they could be, you know, with that type of power. With these spinning things to be anti-gravity or something that can lift up and fly and move very quickly the way Admiral Byrd said, you know, that would be child's play to people who master this technology.
I just recalled something, and I'll have to go back and verify this, but it seems to me that the Betty and Barney Hill abduction story, and they were the sort of the first prominent individuals to talk openly about an alien abduction. It seems to me either Betty or Barney mentioned that while they were aboard this craft, they seem to recall seeing Nazis. Does that ring a bell with you? No,
yeah.
Pun intended.
That's a common statement from people who claim abduction, that they were German speaking people or, you know, implied Nazis. And it just doesn't fit in with, you know, the alien presence. But that comes up over and over and over again, that we have two very distinct, you know, types of people occupying craft like that. The typical alien, obviously alien type person, and then someone who looks just like us and speaks German, but is just remarkably advanced technologically.
This Nancy Bell, again, the technology, you know, 70, 80 years old, think of what they have now. I mean, when I say they, I don't even know who I mean. The Nazi International, the whoever you want to call them, the, you know, the elite, the oligarchs, the unelected oligarchs, the Bilderbergs, whatever you want to call them. This break, they, as Richard Dolan says, they constitute a breakaway civilization because they have this technology at their disposal. But imagine the Nancy Bell plus 80 years.
Yes. One of the big things the ultra-rich are getting into for private yachts are submarines. So a company that makes these high-end submarines for them, and they're hundreds of millions of dollars. They're hardly toys. You know, back when I looked into the 2007 trip with Mr. Allen, they sold 100 of them.
Remarkable.
So, you know, the billionaire yacht club is doing quite well. The, one of the patents for this what they call vortex tube, and the patent of the Verbell Rohr bell was in 1935. And, you know, Professor Max Steenbeck, Swiss scientist Dr. Walter Dahlenbach, and it was Steenbeck who worked with the Soviets to create their bell, which was called Tokamak. And then a 1934 Hungarian scientist, Leo Szilard, he patented something very similar as well, because you're turning one element into another element by creating a mercury plasma with thorium.
It's alchemy at its worst. George, always a pleasure. Keep doing what you're doing. We really appreciate your work, and it's always a delight having you on the program. And people, again, the website, George?
www.conspiracy-cafe.com, or just Google my name. I'm everywhere where it comes up, get more hits than the Prime Minister. And I can sleep nights.
All right, George, Merry Christmas.
You too, my friend. Bye-bye.
George Freund. All right. It's been 4 weeks since hackers calling themselves Guardians of Peace began their cyber-terrorism campaign against Sony Pictures Entertainment. In that time, thousands of executive emails and other documents have been posted online. Employees and their families were threatened, and unreleased films were reportedly stolen and made available for illegal download. And of course, the film, which supposedly cost somewhere in the order of $75 million, that would be The Interview, where two sort of unlikely candidates are recruited by U.S. intelligence, their mission to assassinate North Korea's president, Kim Il-jun. And we're hearing now that that's not what happened. The North Koreans are not behind this entertainment hack, and at least that's the take of our media scientist friend Nelson Thal, who joins us now. Hello, Nelson.
Good. How are you doing, Richard?
I'm well. I'm well. So, what do you hear? What do you know? The North Koreans not at all responsible for this hack?
You know, I think that we remember we start from the fact that we're standing on the shoulders of giants. And, you know, all the media scientists understand that events are well scripted and designed for desirable effects. And we call that state psyops, and that's the name of the Twitter. Isn't that right, Richard?
Yes, we should mention there's a button on the richardserrett.com, state psyops, and for,
it's
that's Nelson's
propaganda enthusiast.
All right. So,
So there's
what stinks as far as the story? Yeah, what doesn't sit well with you? The official line is that evil North Korea. I mean, there's no question that.
Well, I listened to the CEO of Linden today, and when you look at what he said, they were just not plausible. He said that CNN that he had spoken to the U.S. government and to think tanks as well that work with the U.S. government, and he said that he asked them if doing a movie about the assassination of the head of state would be a problem or cause a threat, and he said that the U.S. government and the think tanks said no.
So, what are you saying, that they were goaded into this?
Would you have any think tank that I've ever been involved in and would say, hey, you're doing a movie about the assassination of the Korean leader, that's going to cause some problems.
Well, and let's face it, Kim Jong-un is not the most stable of individuals. So, I mean, yeah. It stands to reason that if you were to make a film about assassinating someone like Kim Jong-un, he's going to react. But so...
Oh, yeah. Well, Rich, remember this. On November the 19th, Route 66, an episode of the popular TV show aired in prime time. The episode was called "I'm Here to Kill a King." Okay, and it was dealt with the political assassination. November 19th, Route 66. I'm Here to Kill a King.
So some preemptive programming.
It starred the episode was produced well in advance of the Kennedy assassination and quarters believing it was part of a predictive programming operation.
Sorry. Yes. Right.
Now, let's keep in mind that the movie Manchurian Candidate, based on the 62 novel, with the same title, was about a former Korean POW named Raymond Shaw, who was brainwashed during his captivity by communist agents, the Soviets and Chinese programmed Shaw to assassinate a presidential candidate. Do I have to go into what the obvious is there? Experts on the CIA's MKUltra mind control program see similarities between Shaw character and the Oswald character, both military veterans. So there's a lot of...
You're saying that, Nelson, that this movie, The Interview, is predictive programming and that we're being set up for some sort of a false flag which could involve the assassination of a president,
well,
God
forfend.
Well, according
to hacked emails from Sony Picture execs, a scene where Kim Jong-un is hit by a tank shell, scattering brain matter, skull fragments, and burnt flesh and hair in all directions, was approved by the U.S. State Department Special Envoy for Human Rights, Ambassador Robert King, and an unnamed, quote, very senior, unquote, official in the State Department. So apparently the CIA's use of Hollywood for its psychological warfare, predictive programming, and soft power projection operations is as strong as it ever was in the past. That's for sure we can say.
Now, what about this claim that Sony said that their 75 million that they lost by not screening the interview would be covered by insurance? You said there's a problem with that. That doesn't ring true.
Well, exactly. He says that he had insurance to cover the financial loss here, but all insurance contracts contained exemptions for acts of God and acts of war. And as you and I both know, we've studied one of the ways of finding out the truth about a lot of these aircraft accidents is we go right to the insurance report, because the insurance guys always do say what's really happening, because their neck's on the line. They're not going to pay for TWA-800 if the admiral took an ad out in the New York Times saying that it was shot down by a missile. They're going to say, hey, look, your own admiral says it was a missile. It's an act of war. We're not paying you TWA. So you can find out, and that's what we do as scientists. We find out what really is being written about it. I mean, Richard, this event could merely be the trigger, the predestined trigger, to wake up sleepers in America, like a lone wolf activation code. Sophisticated people in the operations end of intelligence agencies know this, deal with this all the time.
But why would Sony allow themselves to be embarrassed in this way? I mean, some of those emails were...
They're not embarrassed, because if you listen to the CEO today, he said, look, we want this released. We're not pulling this. What happened is the theaters came to us and said they wouldn't play it. So they don't come out looking bad. Their bankers aren't angry with them, and the studio industry's not angry with them. and they're not. This isn't going to hurt their brand. And
well, they're being accused of being cowards.
Richard Haz was on CNN, and he's on Farik's show, and he said, "No, this won't hurt their brand, and it won't because, listen, Richard, this is an arm of the military-industrial complex here."
So spell it out for me, Nelson. I'm a simple man. We just got about 30 seconds here. But so what are we being set up for? Is the movie predictive programming, or is the fact that they pulled it from the theaters predictive programming? Spell it out for me.
Listen, the top-down conspiracy always plays catch-up to the bottom-up conspiracy effects, we say. So the owners of the system may be trying to foment another war, another Gulf of Tonkin, another Pearl Harbor, 9/11. There's a lot going on
with North Korea.
Levels,
yeah.
On multiple levels. I'm sure the studio would like the government to allow them to vertically integrate once again and allow the studios to own the theaters, which they haven't been able to do since the antitrust laws were put through.
That's an interesting point. Listen, Nelson, we're out of time. Always a pleasure. And the Twitter feed, at State PsyOps, and you can find it right on the homepage at richardserrett.com. Some great, great material there. Nelson, thanks as always.
Thank you, Richard. Bye-bye.
Nelson Thal. All right, my thanks to Tim Spreen for production, Albert Venzel, story producer, all of you listening at home. Back next week with a brand new program. Hope you'll be along for that. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, nothing hidden that won't be made known. Would I speak in the light, or would I speak in the dark? Speak in the light, would you hear in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops, Merry Christmas. Move over, Aphrodite, I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.